Before the foundations of the world, a divine decree echoed through eternity. The elder shall serve the younger. Two nations battled within one womb, and God whispered a prophecy that would shatter human understanding of justice. Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated, words spoken before either child drew breath or chose between good and evil. But what ancient secrets lie hidden in this divine hatred? What mysterious forces shaped a destiny written in blood and birthright? Tonight, we unveil the forbidden truth about the man who traded eternity for a single meal, whose very existence challenges everything you thought you knew about God's love. Enter the shadows of predestination, where free will meets divine sovereignty, and discover why Esau's story terrifies theologians to this day. Picture this. Isaac stood at the edge of his tent, watching the sunset paint the desert sky orange and red. He was 60 years old now, and still no children had blessed his household. 20 long years had passed since he married beautiful Rebecca, and their home remained heartbreakingly silent. No tiny voices calling out in the morning, no small hands tugging at his robes, just emptiness where laughter should have been. But Isaac wasn't the kind of man to give up easily. Every single day, he remembered the promise God had made to his father Abraham. The Lord had sworn that Abraham's descendants would be as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. Yet here was Isaac, Abraham's only son of promise, and he had no children at all. How could God's promise come true if the family line ended with him? So Isaac did what he knew best. He prayed. Genesis 25:21 tells us exactly what he did. Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren. But this wasn't just a casual prayer thrown up to heaven. The Hebrew word used here means he pleaded with God, begged him, interceded with all his heart. Day after day, month after month, year after year, Isaac poured out his soul before God. Can you imagine the weight on Isaac's shoulders? He carried not just his own desire for children, but the future of God's covenant promises. Every morning when he woke up, he had to choose between despair and faith. Every night when he went to sleep, he had to trust that God had not forgotten his word. Isaac's prayer wasn't just about wanting a family. It was about believing that God keeps his promises even when everything looks impossible. Think about Rebecca during those 20 years. She watched other women in the camp grow round with child, hold babies to their chests, chase toddlers around the tents. She felt the sting of emptiness every time someone asked when she would have children. Yet she stood by her husband as he prayed, adding her own tears and hopes to his daily pleas before the Lord. The silence from heaven stretched on and on, but Isaac kept praying. He had seen God provide a ram when his father was about to sacrifice him on Mount Moriah. He had witnessed God's faithfulness throughout Abraham's life. So even when 20 years felt like forever, Isaac refused to stop believing that God would answer. Then one day, everything changed. After 2 decades of waiting, God finally opened Rebecca's womb. The joy in their tent must have been overwhelming. Isaac's prayers had been answered. The covenant promise would continue. But as the months went by, something very strange began to happen inside Rebecca's body. This wasn't a normal pregnancy. Genesis 25:22 describes it with words that make your skin crawl. The children struggled together within her. The Hebrew word for struggled means they were crushing each other, battling violently like warriors fighting to the death. Can you imagine what this felt like for poor Rebecca? She had waited 20 years for this blessing, and now it felt like a nightmare. The pain was unlike anything she had ever experienced. These babies weren't just moving around normally. They were at war inside her womb. The violence of their struggle was so intense that Rebecca feared for her life. She probably wondered if carrying these children would kill her. Day and night, the battle raged inside her body. She couldn't sleep, couldn't eat properly, couldn't find any position that brought relief. The other women in the camp had never seen anything like it. They whispered among themselves, wondering what could cause such a terrible pregnancy. Some probably thought it was a curse rather than a blessing. The struggle was so fierce and so constant that Rebecca reached her breaking point. Genesis 25:22 records her desperate cry, "If all is well, why am I like this?" She couldn't understand why God would answer their prayers for children only to put her through such agony. What kind of blessing comes wrapped in so much pain? But this wasn't just random suffering. Unknown to Rebecca, the violent wrestling match happening inside her womb was actually a preview of the future. These two babies were already acting out the conflict that would define their entire lives. The war between them had begun before they even took their first breath. Every kick, every punch, every struggle was setting the stage for a rivalry that would last for generations. Rebecca didn't know it yet, but she was carrying the seeds of two nations that would be locked in conflict for centuries to come. The pain she felt was the birth pangs of a struggle that would echo through history. Rebecca had reached her limit. The constant battle inside her womb was driving her to desperation. She needed answers, and she needed them now. So she did exactly what her husband had done for 20 years. She went straight to God. The end of Genesis 25:22 tells us, "So she went to inquire of the Lord." She didn't waste time asking the other women in the camp for their opinions. She didn't try to figure it out on her own. She went directly to the source of all truth. Rebecca threw herself before the Lord and begged him to explain what was happening to her. Why was her pregnancy so different? Why was she suffering so much? What did this violent struggle mean? And God gave her an answer that must have left her speechless. When the Lord spoke, his words revealed not just the immediate situation, but the destiny of nations yet to come. Genesis 25:23 records the divine response. "Two nations are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." Stop and let that sink in for a moment. God wasn't just talking about two difficult babies. He was pulling back the curtain of time itself and showing Rebecca the future of entire civilizations. These twin boys wrestling in her womb would become the fathers of two different peoples who would be locked in conflict for generations upon generations. But the most shocking part of God's prophecy was the complete reversal of natural order. In their culture, the firstborn son got everything. The family inheritance, the father's blessing, the right to lead the clan. The older son was automatically more important than the younger. It was the way things had always been done, the foundation of their entire social structure. Yet God declared that all these traditions would be turned upside down. The older would serve the younger. The secondborn would rule over the firstborn. This wasn't just unusual. It was revolutionary. God was announcing that his plans don't follow human customs or expectations. The divine will would override every earthly tradition. Rebecca must have stared in wonder at her swollen belly, knowing now that the battle raging inside her was actually the beginning of a conflict that would shape the course of history. Two nations were literally fighting for position before they were even born. Now we come to the most mind-bending part of this entire story. Long before these babies took their first breath, long before they made their first choice between right and wrong, God had already decided which one he would choose. The Apostle Paul makes this crystal clear in Romans 9:11 to 13. "For the children being not yet born, nor having done any good or evil, that the purpose of God according to election might stand, not of works, but of him that calls. It was said unto her, the older shall serve the younger. As it is written, Jacob have I loved, but Esau have I hated." Think about what this means for just a moment. Before Esau could say his first word, before he could take his first step, before he could make a single decision about how to live his life, God had already determined his destiny. This wasn't based on God looking into the future and seeing what kind of person Esau would become. This was based on nothing except God's own sovereign will. This completely shatters our normal way of thinking about fairness and justice. We want to believe that God's love and favor depend on how good we are, how hard we try, how much we deserve His blessing. We like to think that if we just work hard enough and make the right choices, we can earn God's approval. But Esau's story destroys that comfortable illusion. God's choice had nothing to do with merit, nothing to do with effort, nothing to do with worthiness. Jacob was chosen, and Esau was rejected based entirely on the mysterious purposes of God's will. Before either twin had done anything good or evil, the divine decision had already been made. One would be loved, the other would be hated. One would be chosen, the other would be passed by. This doctrine of divine election is one of the most difficult teachings in all of Scripture. It forces us to confront the absolute sovereignty of God and the complete inability of human beings to control their own eternal destiny. We are not in charge of whether God chooses us or rejects us. That decision belongs to Him alone. The uncomfortable truth is that Esau was marked for rejection before he ever had the chance to prove himself worthy or unworthy. His fate was sealed in the mind of God before time began. This wasn't cruel arbitrariness on God's part. It was the outworking of divine purposes far beyond human understanding. When the time finally came for Rebekah to give birth, everything seemed to follow the expected pattern. Genesis 25:25 describes the moment, "And the first came out red. He was like a hairy garment all over. So they called his name Esau." There he was, the firstborn son, covered with reddish hair from head to toe. By every law of nature and custom, this baby boy should have been the heir to God's covenant promises. In their culture, being born first meant everything. The firstborn received a double portion of the inheritance. He got the family blessing. He became the leader of the clan when his father died. He carried on the family name and traditions. If you were born first, you won the lottery of life. If you came second, you got whatever was left over. So when Esau emerged from Rebekah's womb first, it looked like he had secured his place as the important son. Isaac probably held his firstborn boy with pride, thinking, "This is the child who will continue Abraham's line. This is the son through whom God's promises will be fulfilled." By all human reasoning, Esau had claimed the prize. But God had already spoken a different word. The older would serve the younger. This meant that every normal expectation, every cultural tradition, every reasonable assumption was about to be shattered. Esau might have won the race out of the womb, but he had already lost the race for God's favor. The divine decree had overruled the birth order. This reversal wasn't an accident or a mistake. It was God's deliberate plan to demonstrate that His ways are not our ways. Human society prizes the firstborn, but God had chosen the secondborn. People value natural order, but God delights in supernatural reversals. The world crowns the obvious winner, but God often picks the underdog. Throughout Scripture, we see this pattern repeated over and over. Isaac was chosen over Ishmael. Jacob was chosen over Esau. Joseph was exalted over his older brothers. David was picked over his older siblings. God seems to take special pleasure in turning human expectations upside down. Esau's birthright was both a blessing and a curse. Yes, he was first, but God had already determined that being first wouldn't matter. The prize that should have been his by right of birth was destined to slip through his fingers. Of all the difficult statements in Scripture, few are more shocking than Romans 9:13. "Jacob have I loved, but Esau have I hated." How can a loving God hate someone before they're even born? These words have troubled believers for centuries and sparked countless theological debates. But we can't ignore them just because they make us uncomfortable. The word "hated" here doesn't necessarily mean that God felt emotional fury or anger toward Esau. In Hebrew and Greek culture, this language was sometimes used to express a strong preference or choice. When Jesus said in Luke 14:26 that his followers must hate their father and mother, he was using the same kind of comparative language. He meant that our love for him should be so strong that all other loves seem like hatred in comparison. But even with this understanding, we can't soften the statement too much. God made a clear, definitive choice between these twins. Jacob was the object of divine love and election. Esau was the object of divine rejection and hatred. There's no getting around the fact that God deliberately picked one brother over the other before either had done anything to deserve favor or punishment. This divine hatred wasn't based on God's foreknowledge of what Esau would do wrong. It wasn't punishment for future sins or reward for future righteousness. The choice was made entirely in the sovereign will of God, completely independent of any human actions or decisions. Esau was hated simply because God chose to hate him. This challenges every natural instinct we have about justice and fairness. We want God's love to be conditional, earned by good behavior and lost by bad behavior. We want divine favor to make sense according to human standards of merit and worthiness. But God's choice of Jacob over Esau shows us that divine election operates by entirely different rules. The mystery deepens when we realize that this choice was made not just for individuals, but for entire nations. God's love for Jacob meant blessing for the nation of Israel. God's hatred for Esau meant centuries of conflict for the nation of Edom. One divine decision in eternity past shaped the destiny of millions of people who hadn't even been born yet. Some try to explain this by saying God simply knew in advance what kind of people Jacob and Esau would become. But Paul specifically says in Romans 9:11 that God's choice was made before the children had done any good or evil. The election wasn't based on foreseen actions. It was based purely on the purpose of God. God's prophecy about these wrestling twins reached far beyond their individual lives. He was looking down the corridor of time, seeing the great nations that would spring from each brother's seed. The implications of his choice between Jacob and Esau would ripple through centuries of human history. Jacob would become Israel, and from his 12 sons would come the 12 tribes that would inherit the promised land. Through Jacob's lineage would flow kings like David and Solomon, prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah, and ultimately the Messiah himself. The nation born from Jacob would be called God's chosen people, the apple of his eye, the recipients of his special covenant love. But Esau wouldn't disappear into obscurity. He would become the father of the Edomites, a strong and proud nation that would build their capital city in the rocky strongholds of Mount Seir. Genesis 36 gives us the genealogy of Esau's descendants, showing how they multiplied and became a powerful people in their own right. They were warriors and traders, skilled in warfare and wealthy from commerce. The prophecy in Genesis 25:23 had declared, "One people shall be stronger than the other." Throughout history, we see this playing out in the relationship between Israel and Edom. Sometimes the Edomites had the upper hand, controlling important trade routes and building impressive cities. Sometimes Israel dominated, conquering Edomite territory and making them pay tribute. But the ultimate fulfillment of "the older shall serve the younger" came during the reign of King David. 2 Samuel 8:14 records, "He put garrisons in Edom. Throughout all Edom he put garrisons, and all the Edomites became David's servants." The older brother's descendants were finally serving the younger brother's descendants, exactly as God had foretold before either was born. The conflict between these two nations would become legendary. The Edomites would refuse to let Israel pass through their territory during the wilderness wandering. They would raid Israelite settlements, ally with Israel's enemies, and celebrate when Jerusalem fell to foreign invaders. The prophet Obadiah would pronounce God's judgment on Edom for their treatment of their brother nation Israel. Every battle between Israel and Edom was essentially a continuation of the struggle that began in Rebekah's womb. Two nations fighting, just as two babies had fought before they were born. The wrestling match that had caused Rebekah so much pain was still going on centuries later. Played out on the stage of international politics and warfare, Esau's story confronts us with questions that have no easy answers. If God chooses some people and rejects others before they're even born, what does that say about divine justice? If Esau was hated by God from the beginning, did he ever really have a chance to change his destiny? Was he doomed to fail before he even started? These questions have divided the church for centuries. Some theologians argue that God's election must be based on his foreknowledge, that he looked ahead in time, saw the choices each person would make, and chose or rejected them accordingly. This view tries to preserve human free will and make God's choices seem more fair by human standards. Others maintain that divine election is completely unconditional, that God's choice has nothing to do with foreseen faith or works, but is based entirely on his own sovereign will and purpose. This view emphasizes God's absolute freedom to choose whom he will use for his glory, regardless of human merit or demerit. The Apostle Paul anticipated these objections in Romans 9, 14-15. What shall we say then? Is there unrighteousness with God? Certainly not. For he says to Moses, I will have mercy on whomever I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whomever I will have compassion. Paul's answer is that God has the absolute right to choose whom he will bless and whom he will pass by. But this raises even more difficult questions. If God predestined some to salvation and others to damnation, how can he hold anyone accountable for their choices? Paul addresses this too in Romans 9, 19-20. You will say to me then, why does he still find fault? For who has resisted his will? But indeed, O man, who are you to reply against God? Will the thing formed say to him who formed it, why have you made me like this? The ultimate answer to these questions is found in Isaiah 55, 8-9. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. God's wisdom is so far above human understanding that we cannot fully comprehend his purposes or judge his actions. What we can know for certain is that God is perfectly just, perfectly wise, and perfectly good. Even when his choices seem harsh or unfair by human standards, they are always right. Esau's story teaches us that God's sovereignty extends even to the mystery of election and predestination. The man who was hated before his birth reminds us that salvation is entirely a gift of grace, never a matter of human merit or achievement. The moment had finally arrived. After months of violent wrestling in Rebecca's womb, the day of birth had come. You can imagine the tension in Isaac's tent as Rebecca went into labor. Would both babies survive this traumatic pregnancy? What would these fighting children look like when they finally emerged into the world? Genesis 25:25 gives us the vivid details of that dramatic moment. And the first came out red. He was like a hairy garment all over. So they called his name Esau. Picture this scene. Out comes the first baby, completely covered in reddish hair from head to toe. Not just a little peach fuzz, but thick hair like a fur coat. The midwives had never seen anything like it. This wasn't a normal newborn. This was something extraordinary. The Hebrew word for red is the same word used to describe red clay or red soil. Esau didn't just have red hair. His entire body had a reddish tint, as if he had been formed from the red earth itself. And the hair covering him was so thick that the text says he looked like a hairy garment, like someone wearing a fur cloak. But the drama wasn't over yet. Genesis 25:26 continues the birth story. Afterward, his brother came out, and his hand took hold of Esau's heel. So his name was called Jacob. Can you picture this incredible moment? As Esau was being born, his twin brother was right behind him, actually grabbing onto Esau's heel with his tiny fist. This wasn't an accident. This wasn't just normal twin positioning. Jacob was literally trying to pull his brother back so he could come out first instead. Even in the birth canal, these boys were still fighting for position. The struggle that had tormented Rebecca for months was continuing right up to the moment of delivery. Think about what the midwives must have thought when they saw this. Here was baby number two, gripping his brother's heel like he was trying to trip him up. It was as if Jacob understood, even as a newborn, that being second meant losing everything. So he made one last desperate attempt to change the birth order. The image is almost comical if you think about it. Two babies in a wrestling match even as they're being born. But it was also deeply prophetic. This heel-grabbing moment would define their entire relationship. Jacob would spend his whole life trying to get ahead of his older brother, always reaching for what belonged to Esau. In biblical times, names weren't just labels, they were prophecies. Parents chose names that captured the essence of their children or predicted their futures. The names given to these twins would prove to be incredibly significant. Esau's name came directly from his unusual appearance at birth. The word Esau is connected to the Hebrew word, usad, which means to make or to do, but it's also related to Seah, meaning hairy. His name literally meant hairy or rough. Every time someone called his name, they were reminded of that moment when he came out looking like a little wild animal covered in fur. But Esau would later get another name that was even more telling. Genesis 25:30 shows us how he became known as Edom, which means red. This name would stick with him and eventually become the name of his entire nation. The Edomites would forever be identified with their ancestor's reddish appearance and his connection to red things. Jacob's name was even more prophetic. Genesis 25:26 explains it clearly. His name was called Jacob because his hand took hold of Esau's heel. The name Jacob comes from the Hebrew word akev, meaning heel. But it also carries the idea of following closely behind, or even more significantly, supplanting or deceiving. A heel grabber isn't just someone who follows behind. It's someone who trips you up, who pulls you back so they can get ahead. In their culture, calling someone a heel grabber was like calling them a schemer or a trickster. Jacob's name basically meant the one who takes your place by deception. Years later, when Esau realized how perfectly his brother's name fit his character, he would cry out in Genesis 27:36, "Is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times." Esau finally understood that his brother's name had been a warning from the very beginning. Every time Isaac called for Jacob, he was unknowingly calling for the supplanter. Every time Rebekah spoke Jacob's name, she was saying the deceiver. The name was like a prophecy waiting to be fulfilled, a prediction of the character that would eventually emerge. These names would become the foundation of their identities. Esau would live up to his name as the wild, rough, impulsive man of the outdoors. Jacob would prove himself to be exactly what his name suggested, the cunning schemer who would do whatever it took to get what he wanted. As the boys grew up, something dangerous began to develop in Isaac's household, parental favoritism. This wasn't just a slight preference or a parent having a special soft spot for one child. This was full-blown, obvious favoritism that would poison the family atmosphere and set the stage for future disaster. Genesis 25:27-28 reveals the devastating family dynamic. So the boys grew, and Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field. But Jacob was a mild man dwelling in tents, and Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game. But Rebekah loved Jacob. Look at that carefully. Isaac's love for his son was tied directly to what Esau could do for him. Isaac was now an old man, and his taste buds had become one of his greatest pleasures. He couldn't see well anymore, his body was weak, but he could still enjoy a good meal. And Esau had become a master hunter who knew exactly how to prepare wild game the way his father liked it. The smell of roasted venison cooking over the fire would make Isaac's mouth water with anticipation. But here's what's so tragic about this favoritism. Isaac's love was conditional. He didn't love Esau for who he was as a person. He loved him for what he could provide. Every time Esau came home with a fresh deer or gazelle, Isaac's face would light up. "There's my boy. What did you bring me today?" The message was clear. Esau's value as a son was tied to his ability to satisfy his father's appetite. Think about how this affected Esau's development. He learned that the way to earn love and approval was through performance, through bringing home impressive trophies from his hunting expeditions. He became addicted to the praise he received when he succeeded in the wilderness. His identity became wrapped up in being the strong, capable outdoor son who could provide for the family. This favoritism also meant that Isaac was blind to Esau's character flaws. He didn't see the impulsiveness, the lack of wisdom, the disregard for spiritual things that was growing in his firstborn son. All he could focus on was the delicious meals and the pride he felt in having such a skilled hunter for a son. But favoritism is a poison that spreads through the entire family system. When one child is clearly preferred, it creates resentment, competition, and dysfunction that can last for generations. Isaac's love for Esau's venison was about to tear his family apart. On the other side of this toxic family dynamic was Rebekah's obvious favoritism toward Jacob. While Isaac was lavishing attention on his hunter son, Rebekah was quietly investing her love and attention in the boy who stayed close to home. The same verse that reveals Isaac's favoritism also exposes Rebekah's. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game. But Rebekah loved Jacob, unlike Isaac, whose favoritism seemed to be based on what he got out of the relationship. Rebekah's preference for Jacob appears to have deeper roots. Remember, Rebekah was the one who had received the prophecy from God before the twins were born. She was the one who had been told that the older shall serve the younger. While Isaac seemed to have forgotten or ignored this divine word, Rebekah carried it in her heart. Every time she looked at Jacob, she remembered that this was the child God had chosen. Jacob was also more like his mother in temperament. While Esau was out in the wilderness chasing wild animals, Jacob was content to stay near the family tents. He was quieter, more thoughtful, more interested in the domestic aspects of life. Rebekah could relate to this. She had been raised in a household herself, and she understood the value of someone who could manage things at home. But Rebekah's favoritism was just as dangerous as Isaac's, maybe even more so. While Isaac's preference for Esau was somewhat passive, he just enjoyed the meals and the hunting stories, Rebekah's love for Jacob would eventually become active and scheming. She wouldn't just favor Jacob with extra attention and affection. She would actively work to make sure he got what she believed God had promised him. This created a house divided against itself. Isaac and Esau on one side, Rebekah and Jacob on the other. The parents were working against each other, each pushing their favored son while undermining the other. Family meals must have been tense affairs, with undercurrents of competition and resentment flowing beneath every conversation. The boys couldn't help but pick up on this division. Esau knew his mother didn't approve of him the way his father did. Jacob knew his father saw him as the lesser son. This parental favoritism was shaping their characters in ways that would have lasting consequences. As Esau grew from boyhood into manhood, his character became more and more defined by his life in the wilderness. Genesis 25:27 describes him as a skillful hunter, a man of the field. This wasn't just his hobby or his job. This was his entire identity. Esau lived for the thrill of the hunt. He knew every animal track in the region, every watering hole where deer came to drink, every cave where bears might be hiding. He could read the wind, follow a trail that was days old, and bring down prey with arrows from distances that would amaze other men. The wilderness was his classroom, and he had become its best student, but Esau's outdoor lifestyle shaped more than just his skills. It shaped his entire approach to life. Men who live in the wild learn to think in terms of immediate needs and instant gratification. When you're hungry, you hunt. When you're tired, you sleep. When you see an opportunity, you take it without thinking about long-term consequences. This is exactly what we see developing in Esau's character. He became a man driven by his appetites and impulses. If he wanted something, he wanted it right now. If he was hungry, food became the most important thing in the world. If he was angry, he acted on that anger immediately. The wilderness doesn't teach you patience or planning. It teaches you to survive in the moment. Esau's identity became wrapped up in his physical strength and abilities. He was proud of his muscles, proud of his hunting skills, proud of his reputation as a man who could survive anywhere. But this pride in his physical capabilities came with a corresponding neglect of spiritual and intellectual development. While other men his age might be learning about family traditions, studying the promises God had made to their grandfather Abraham, or developing wisdom and judgment, Esau was focused on becoming the ultimate outdoorsman. He could track a wounded animal for miles, but he couldn't track the consequences of his own actions. The wilderness made Esau self-reliant in some ways, but it also made him short-sighted. Animals don't plan for next year, they just try to survive today. And Esau was becoming more like the animals he hunted than the man of God he should have been becoming. While Esau was developing his identity in the wilderness, Jacob was becoming a completely different kind of man. Genesis 25:27 describes him as a mild man, dwelling in tents. The word mild here doesn't mean weak or timid. It means complete, mature, or even perfect in the sense of being well-developed. Jacob was what we might call a homebody. While his brother was chasing animals across the desert, Jacob was content to stay near the family camp. He learned the domestic arts, understood how to manage livestock, and became skilled in all the practical aspects of running a household. But Jacob's tent-dwelling lifestyle gave him something his brother lacked: time to think. While Esau was focused on immediate survival in the wilderness, Jacob had the luxury of contemplation. He could observe family dynamics, think about the future, and plan ahead. He became a student of human nature rather than animal nature. Living close to home also meant that Jacob was constantly exposed to the family's spiritual heritage. He heard the stories about his grandfather Abraham's encounters with God. He listened to his father Isaac talk about God's promises and blessings. He understood the significance of the covenant in a way that his wilderness-dwelling brother never did. Jacob developed what we might call strategic thinking. While Esau was reactive, responding immediately to whatever situation presented itself, Jacob was proactive. He thought about what he wanted and then figured out how to get it. He understood that the most important things in life required patience and planning. This doesn't mean Jacob was necessarily more righteous than Esau. His calculating nature would eventually lead him to deceive his father and steal his brother's blessing. But it does mean that Jacob understood the value of spiritual things in a way that Esau never did. He recognized that being the heir to God's covenant was worth more than any amount of physical comfort or immediate gratification. Jacob's tent-dwelling lifestyle also made him more attuned to relationships and emotions. He watched how his parents interacted, noticed who got favored and who got overlooked, and learned how to navigate complex family dynamics. He became skilled at reading people and understanding their motivations. Where Esau was becoming wild and impulsive, Jacob was becoming civilized and calculating. Where Esau lived for the moment, Jacob planned for the future. These contrasting characters were setting the stage for a conflict that would define both their lives. As the twins grew into young men, it became clear that they weren't just different in personality. They had developed completely opposite value systems. What mattered most to one brother meant almost nothing to the other. Esau's values centered around immediate physical satisfaction. He valued strength, skill, adventure, and the satisfaction of his appetites. When he was hungry, getting food was the most important thing in the world. When he was tired, rest became his top priority. When he saw something he wanted, obtaining it immediately took precedence over everything else. This isn't to say that Esau was evil or malicious. He was just a man driven by his physical nature rather than his spiritual nature. He lived in the here and now, focused on what he could see, touch, taste, and experience with his senses. The invisible world of spiritual inheritance and divine promises seemed abstract and unreal to him. Jacob, on the other hand, had developed an entirely different set of priorities. He understood that some things were worth waiting for, even if it meant temporary discomfort or sacrifice. He valued the intangible over the immediate, the permanent over the temporary, the spiritual over the physical. This difference in values would show up in all kinds of ways. Esau might trade away something valuable for immediate gratification, while Jacob would sacrifice present pleasure for future gain. Esau trusted in his own strength and abilities, while Jacob was more likely to use his intelligence and planning to achieve his goals. The brothers also had different relationships with their family's spiritual heritage. For Jacob, the promises God had made to Abraham and Isaac were real and valuable. The idea of being the heir to God's covenant was something worth pursuing. But for Esau, all of that spiritual stuff was just abstract concepts that didn't mean much in practical, everyday life. These conflicting values meant that the brothers were essentially living in different worlds, even though they shared the same household. They couldn't understand each other's priorities or motivations. What seemed incredibly important to one seemed completely worthless to the other. This fundamental difference in values was creating the perfect setup for conflict. When two people want completely different things, they can usually find a way to coexist peacefully. But when they both want the same thing for completely different reasons, conflict becomes inevitable. All of these elements, the parental favoritism, the contrasting personalities, the conflicting values, and the divine prophecy hanging over everything, were creating a perfect storm in Isaac's household. The stage was being set for betrayal, deception, and family destruction. The favoritism problem was getting worse as the boys got older. Isaac's preference for Esau was becoming more obvious and more problematic. He wasn't just enjoying Esau's hunting success, he was actively planning to pass the family blessing and inheritance to his favored son. Despite God's prophecy that the older would serve the younger, Rebecca was watching this favoritism with growing alarm. She remembered God's words about Jacob being chosen, and she could see her husband preparing to bless the wrong son. Her love for Jacob was starting to transform into active scheming. She was beginning to think about ways to make sure God's prophecy would be fulfilled, even if she had to deceive her own husband to do it. The brothers themselves were growing increasingly different in every way that mattered. Esau's impulsive, immediate gratification approach to life was making him careless about things that should have been precious to him. Jacob's calculating, long-term thinking was making him more and more resentful of his second-born status. Jacob knew he was the chosen one according to God's prophecy, but he was watching his father prepare to give everything to Esau instead. This created a sense of injustice and desperation that would eventually drive him to take matters into his own hands. If God's will wasn't going to happen naturally, maybe it needed some human assistance. The family dynamics were becoming toxic. Instead of working together toward common goals, everyone was pursuing their own agenda. Isaac wanted to bless his favorite son. Rebecca wanted to ensure Jacob's success. Esau wanted to maintain his position as the firstborn. Jacob wanted what he believed God had promised him. All of these conflicting desires and loyalties were creating pressure that would eventually explode in deception and betrayal. The foundation was being laid for one of the most dramatic family conflicts in all of Scripture. The man who was hated by God before his birth was also being set up for betrayal by the people who should have loved him most. It was just another hunting day for Esau. He had left camp early that morning with his bow and arrows, tracking game across the wilderness as he had done countless times before. But this particular day would be different from all the others. This would be the day that changed everything. Genesis 25:29 sets the scene. Now Jacob cooked a stew, and Esau came in from the field, and he was weary. Picture Esau stumbling back into camp after what must have been a brutal day in the wilderness. His clothes were torn from pushing through thorny bushes. His face was burned red from the desert sun. His muscles ached from hours of tracking animals that had managed to escape his arrows. But worst of all, Esau was starving. Not just normally hungry, he was famished to the point of desperation. Maybe he had been hunting for days without success. Maybe he had gotten lost and run out of food. Maybe he had been so focused on chasing one particular animal that he had forgotten to eat. Whatever had happened out there in the wilderness, Esau had reached the point where food was the only thing that mattered. As he dragged himself toward his family's tents, a smell hit his nostrils that made his mouth water instantly. Someone was cooking and it smelled incredible. The aroma of seasoned stew bubbling over a fire was like torture to his empty stomach. His body was crying out for nourishment, and every step toward that delicious smell felt like agony. There by the cooking fire sat Jacob, calmly stirring a pot of red lentil stew. The same Jacob who never went hunting, who never took risks in the wilderness, who always stayed safely at home while Esau was out risking his life to provide for the family. And now here was Jacob, well-fed and comfortable, cooking what looked like the most beautiful meal Esau had ever seen. The irony of the moment was crushing. Esau, the great hunter who was supposed to feed everyone else, was now desperately in need of food. Jacob, the quiet tent dweller who never contributed to the family's meals, was the one holding the key to Esau's survival. The roles were completely reversed, and Jacob was about to take full advantage of the situation. Esau's physical exhaustion was about to collide with Jacob's patient planning. The man of action was at the mercy of the man of calculation, and Jacob had been waiting for exactly this kind of moment. Jacob looked up from his cooking pot and saw his brother approaching. One glance at Esau told Jacob everything he needed to know. This wasn't just a tired hunter coming home from a normal day. This was a man pushed to his absolute limit, a man who had reached the breaking point of human endurance. Jacob's mind started working immediately. He had spent years watching his brother receive their father's favor, their father's blessing, their father's pride. He had listened to Isaac talk about passing the family inheritance to Esau simply because he had been born first. Jacob knew that according to God's prophecy, he should be the heir, but according to human custom, everything would go to Esau. This moment of his brother's desperation was exactly what Jacob had been waiting for, even if he hadn't realized it before. Here was Esau, the mighty hunter, reduced to begging for food from his younger brother. Here was the firstborn son, completely dependent on the secondborn for his very survival. The power dynamic had shifted completely, and Jacob was not going to let this opportunity slip away. Genesis 25:30 shows us Esau's desperate plea. And Esau said to Jacob, "Please feed me with that same red stew, for I am weary." The Hebrew word for weary here means utterly exhausted, completely drained, ready to collapse. Esau wasn't just asking for food, he was begging for it. But Jacob didn't immediately rush to help his suffering brother. He didn't offer comfort or concern. Instead, he saw this as the moment he had been unconsciously preparing for his entire life. This was his chance to get what he believed rightfully belonged to him, according to God's plan. Jacob understood something that Esau never grasped: that timing is everything, that the right moment can be more valuable than years of effort, that sometimes the greatest victories come not through strength, but through patience and strategy. While Esau had been focused on immediate physical challenges in the wilderness, Jacob had been studying the bigger picture, understanding the long-term value of spiritual inheritance. Now Jacob held all the cards. His brother was desperate, and desperation makes people do things they would never consider under normal circumstances. Jacob was about to make an offer that would change both their lives forever. Jacob didn't waste time with small talk or sympathy. He went straight to the heart of what he wanted. Genesis 25:31 records his shocking response to his starving brother. But Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright as of this day." Can you imagine the audacity of that moment? Here was Esau, literally dying of hunger, begging his brother for help. And Jacob's response was essentially, "Sure, I'll feed you if you give me everything that's rightfully yours as the firstborn." This wasn't a casual suggestion or a brotherly joke. This was a calculated business proposal delivered at the moment of maximum leverage. The birthright wasn't just a title or a family tradition. It was everything that mattered in their culture. The firstborn received a double portion of the family inheritance, which meant Esau would get twice as much wealth as Jacob when Isaac died. The birthright also included the family blessing, the right to lead the clan, and most importantly, the privilege of carrying on God's covenant promises to Abraham and Isaac. In other words, Jacob was asking Esau to sell his entire future, his inheritance, his blessing, his spiritual destiny, his role as the family patriarch, all for one bowl of stew. It was the most lopsided trade proposal in history. Jacob was offering maybe 30 minutes of physical satisfaction in exchange for a lifetime of blessing and prosperity. But Jacob knew exactly what he was doing. He understood that Esau's impulsive, immediate gratification mindset made him vulnerable to exactly this kind of proposition. While Esau was focused on his growling stomach, Jacob was thinking about the next 50 years. While Esau was consumed with his physical discomfort, Jacob was calculating the eternal value of spiritual inheritance. This wasn't a spur-of-the-moment idea for Jacob. This was the culmination of years of watching, waiting, and planning. He had seen how little his brother valued the spiritual aspects of their family heritage. He had noticed Esau's casual attitude toward the things of God. He had been waiting for the perfect moment to make his move, and that moment had finally arrived. The negotiation was as simple as it was devastating. Jacob had something Esau desperately needed, and Esau had something Jacob desperately wanted. The question was whether Esau's hunger was strong enough to make him trade away his entire birthright for temporary relief. Esau's response to Jacob's proposal reveals everything we need to know about his character and his values. Genesis 25:32 records his tragic reasoning, and Esau said, "Look, I am about to die. So what is the use of a birthright to me?" Stop and think about what Esau was saying here. He was claiming that he was literally at death's door, that his hunger was so severe that he would die if he didn't eat immediately. Now, maybe he was genuinely in serious physical distress, but more likely, this was the kind of dramatic exaggeration that hungry people often make when they're uncomfortable. But even if we take Esau at his word, even if he really believed he was about to die, his logic was still completely flawed. He was essentially saying, "What good is my inheritance if I'm dead?" But here's what he failed to consider. Even if he was genuinely close to death, trading away his birthright was permanent. While his hunger was temporary, Esau could have said, "Jacob, I'm your brother and I'm in desperate need. Please help me, and I promise I'll make it up to you later." He could have offered Jacob money or livestock or hunting services. He could have asked their father Isaac to intervene. He could have sent servants to get food from neighboring camps. There were dozens of ways to solve his immediate problem without giving up his eternal inheritance, but Esau's mind didn't work that way. He was incapable of seeing past his immediate physical discomfort to the long-term consequences of his decision. His entire world had shrunk down to the gnawing pain in his stomach and the delicious smell coming from Jacob's cooking pot. Everything else, his future, his family's blessing, his spiritual heritage, his descendants' destiny, became irrelevant in the face of his immediate need. This is the tragedy of living by impulse instead of wisdom. When you're driven entirely by your physical appetites and immediate desires, you lose the ability to think clearly about consequences. Esau's hunger had literally clouded his judgment to the point where he couldn't see that he was about to make the worst trade in human history. What makes this even more tragic is that Esau wasn't thinking like a dying man. He was thinking like a man who expected to live but couldn't imagine waiting even a few more hours for relief. A truly dying man would be thinking about his legacy, his family, his spiritual condition. But Esau was just thinking about his stomach. Jacob wasn't taking any chances. He knew his brother well enough to know that Esau might change his mind once his hunger was satisfied. So he demanded more than just a verbal agreement. He required a binding oath that would make the transaction legally and spiritually irreversible. Genesis 25:33 shows us Jacob's insistence on absolute certainty. Then Jacob said, "Swear to me as of this day." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Jacob wasn't going to let his brother eat until the deal was completely sealed. No food would change hands until Esau had sworn a solemn oath before God. In their culture, an oath was the most serious kind of promise you could make. When you swore an oath, you were calling God Himself as your witness. You were essentially saying, "May God punish me if I break this promise." Breaking an oath wasn't just dishonest. It was a sin against God Himself. Jacob understood the power of oaths. He knew that once Esau swore this promise, it would be nearly impossible for him to take it back later. Even if Esau regretted his decision, even if Isaac disapproved, even if the whole family was upset about it, the oath would still be binding. Jacob was making sure that this moment of weakness would have permanent consequences. But think about what this oath meant for Esau. By swearing before God that he was selling his birthright, he was essentially declaring that he valued a bowl of stew more than God's covenant promises. He was announcing to heaven and earth that his physical comfort was more important to him than his spiritual inheritance. This wasn't just a business transaction, it was a spiritual declaration. Esau was formally renouncing his claim to the blessings that God had intended for Abraham's family line. He was voluntarily removing himself from the covenant promises and handing them over to his younger brother. The tragic irony is that Esau probably didn't fully understand what he was doing. He was so focused on getting food that he didn't think about the spiritual implications of his oath. He was swearing away his divine inheritance without even realizing it. The oath that was supposed to simply close a deal was actually closing the door on his entire spiritual future. Jacob, on the other hand, understood exactly what was happening. He was gaining far more than just a legal claim to the family inheritance. He was obtaining God's covenant blessings through his brother's own sworn testimony. The moment Esau finished swearing his oath, Jacob immediately provided the food. There was no delay, no additional conditions, no time for second thoughts. Genesis 25:34 describes the scene, and Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils. Then he ate and drank, arose, and went his way. Picture this moment carefully. Esau grabbed that bowl of red lentil stew like a man who hadn't eaten in days. He probably didn't even taste it properly. He was too desperate to savor the flavors. He wolfed down the food, gulped down whatever drink Jacob provided, and satisfied his immediate hunger as quickly as possible. But notice what happened next. As soon as Esau's physical need was met, as soon as his stomach stopped growling and his energy was restored, he simply got up and walked away. There was no conversation about what had just happened. No discussion of the implications. No moment of reflection about the trade he had just made. Esau treated this world-changing transaction like it was completely routine. He ate, he drank, he stood up and he left. It was as if he had just purchased a normal meal instead of trading away his entire spiritual inheritance. The casual way he walked away reveals everything about his character and his values. This is the behavior of someone who is completely controlled by his physical appetites. Once Esau's hunger was satisfied, he stopped thinking about the situation entirely. The birthright he had just sold meant so little to him that he didn't even want to discuss it. The covenant promises he had just given up were so unimportant to him that he could walk away without a second thought. Jacob, meanwhile, was probably watching his brother leave with a mixture of amazement and satisfaction. He had just obtained everything he had ever wanted, his brother's birthright, his inheritance, his place in God's covenant, and it had cost him nothing but a pot of lentils and some bread. The patient tent dweller had outsmarted the impulsive hunter, but the most revealing part of this entire scene is Esau's complete indifference to what had just occurred. He should have been wrestling with the magnitude of his decision. He should have been thinking about the consequences for his family, his future, his children. Instead, he was already moving on to whatever was next, as if nothing significant had happened at all. The Bible doesn't leave us to wonder what God thought about this transaction. Genesis 25:34 ends with a divine commentary that reveals the true nature of what had just occurred. Thus Esau despised his birthright. These five words contain one of the most devastating character assessments in all of Scripture. The word despised here doesn't mean that Esau felt hatred or anger toward his birthright. It means that he considered it worthless, treated it as unimportant, regarded it as something beneath his concern. In Esau's mind, his birthright was so insignificant that trading it for a single meal was a reasonable decision. This biblical commentary reveals that Esau's problem wasn't just hunger or poor timing or momentary weakness. His problem was a fundamental misunderstanding of value. He literally could not comprehend why his spiritual inheritance should matter more than his immediate physical comfort. The things of God were abstract and meaningless to him, while the things of the flesh were concrete and urgent. Think about what the birthright actually represented. It wasn't just money or land or family leadership. It was the right to carry on God's covenant with Abraham. It was the privilege of being in the family line through which the Messiah would eventually come. It was participation in God's plan to bless all the nations of the earth through Abraham's descendants. But to Esau, all of that spiritual significance was worth less than one bowl of soup. The covenant promises that had sustained his grandfather Abraham through decades of waiting meant nothing to him. The divine blessings that had made his father Isaac wealthy and respected were just abstract concepts. The eternal inheritance that should have been his greatest treasure was something he could trade away without a moment's hesitation. This is why the Bible says he despised his birthright. It wasn't that he actively hated it. It was that he valued it so little that he could treat it as worthless. Esau's great sin wasn't anger or rebellion against God. It was indifference to the things of God. The biblical commentary forces us to see this transaction for what it really was, not just a business deal between brothers, but a spiritual choice between eternal values and temporary pleasures. Esau chose the temporary, and in doing so, he despised the eternal. What happened that day between Jacob and Esau wasn't just a family dispute that would be forgotten in a few years. This single decision to trade the birthright would echo through centuries of human history, affecting not just Esau personally, but entire nations that would come from his descendants. The immediate consequences were obvious. Jacob had legally obtained Esau's inheritance rights and his claim to the family blessing. But the long-term consequences reached far beyond what either brother could have imagined in that moment. Esau's choice to despise his birthright would shape the destiny of millions of people who hadn't even been born yet. Remember that God's prophecy had declared that these twins would become the fathers of two nations. Jacob would become Israel, the chosen people of God, recipients of his special covenant love and blessing. Through Jacob's line would come kings, prophets, and eventually the Messiah himself. The nation of Israel would be called God's treasured possession, the apple of his eye. But Esau would become the father of the Edomites, and his decision to despise his birthright would mark his descendants as well. The Edomites would be a strong people, skilled in warfare and successful in trade. But they would also be characterized by the same indifference to spiritual things that marked their ancestor Esau. Throughout the Old Testament, we see the Edomites consistently choosing immediate political advantage over spiritual wisdom. They would refuse to help their Israelite cousins when they needed assistance. They would ally with Israel's enemies when it served their interests. They would celebrate when Jerusalem fell to foreign invaders. Just like their ancestor Esau, they would repeatedly choose short-term gain over long-term blessing. The prophet Obadiah would eventually pronounce God's judgment on Edom for their treatment of Israel, saying in Obadiah 1:10, "For violence against your brother Jacob, shame shall cover you, and you shall be cut off forever." The descendants of Esau would face divine judgment, partly because they inherited their ancestors' disregard for God's covenant people. But the consequences reached even further than that. Hebrews 12:16-17 uses Esau as a warning to all believers, lest there be any fornicator or profane person like Esau, who for one morsel of food sold his birthright. For you know that afterward, when he wanted to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place for repentance, though he sought it diligently with tears. Esau's story became a warning for all time about the danger of valuing temporary pleasure over eternal inheritance. His decision to trade away his birthright for immediate gratification became the biblical example of what happens when someone treats holy things as common. When someone chooses the physical over the spiritual, when someone lives for the moment instead of for eternity, the man who was hated by God before his birth had now proven by his own actions that God's hatred was justified. By despising his birthright, Esau had demonstrated that he was exactly the kind of person who would treat God's covenant promises as worthless. His choice validated God's original decision to reject him in favor of Jacob. One bowl of soup, one moment of hunger, one impulsive decision, and the consequences would last forever.